Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today it's July 4th celebrations and the start of high summer. It's time to do a lot of hanging out and maybe kind of sneak into cooking occasionally. I mean, look, you don't have to travel and you don't need a lot of money. You could use a shade tree, some goods from the farm stands, and perhaps some friends who like to pitch in. Now, given that, we have got a lineup to help you out. Grill Maven and Gourmet Magazine's executive editor John Willoughby steps us through great crowd food, the craft of smoke roasting. Sally Schneider, she of imagination and improv genius, takes on the slaws of summer. David Rosengarten brings us a fresh take on the burger, while culinary conservationist Gary Nabhan tells us about a different kind of Americana. And as always in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get going with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, you probably are aware that there are three types of clam chowder in the world. Manhattan, which is the red stuff.
Right.
New England, or in Oregon, they serve this also, the creamy stuff.
Right.
And then there's Rhode Island chowder, which is my personal favorite, and it is just, it's gray. It's like gray seawater, but it is the clammiest, brothiest, in my humble opinion, best clam chowder in the world. And we found some of the best at Champlin's Seafood Deck in Narragansett, Rhode Island.
Now, is this then just sort of straight clam broth and clams and then the salt pork and potatoes?
That's exactly it. I don't think there's too much more to it than that. Maybe some oregano or a few other seasonings.
Uh-huh.
But it's very kind of briny sweet, if that makes any sense. I mean, if you love clams, this is the clam chowder for you.
Because the red stuff, Manhattan chowder, can taste a little bit like minestrone if it's not cooked correctly. And the white stuff can taste like library paste
if they put too much flour
in it. But at Champlin's Seafood Deck in Narragansett, this is clam chowder for the true clam chowder aficionado.
I have to ask something, because I love clam chowder, but that part of the country, to me, the high art is the fried clam. Are there fried clams really good?
Oh, yes.
But of course.
They have a full shoreline seafood menu. They have excellent fried clams. They have stuffies, you know, which are the quahog clams that get mixed with linguica sausage and then baked.
In a fritter.
Ooh.
And they have clam fritters. They have clam cakes.
Oh.
They actually have a few things unique, at least one thing that is utterly unique to Rhode Island, which is snail salad. You don't find that anywhere else, but virtually every seafood restaurant in Rhode Island has snail salad.
And these are sea snails?
Yeah.
As opposed to the squishy garden snails?
No, wait a minute. I think these are the, I don't know which kind of snails that, they remind me of octopus. You know, they're kind of like real thin, tender leaves that are marinated in a garlicky
How big is a sea snail?
I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking of periwinkles, which you find on the rocks, and they're very tiny.
No, these are bigger.
I think they're snails like in the garden, you know.
Oh, well, that's lovely. moving on. What else is on the menu?
Pretty much any kind of fish that you want. Flounder, haddock, shrimp, salmon, scup, which I have no idea what that is. Tuna, bass, mackerel. butterfish, codfish, sprod, squid, herring. Should I continue?
Yeah, I got it.
What you have to understand is Narragansett is where all the fishing boats leave from and come in Rhode Island. So you actually get the catch right from the
boats. And in fact, it's called Champlain's Seafood Deck. And, you know, weather permitting, you can dine outside overlooking the fleet.
Oh, gosh, that sounds fabulous.
It's very nice.
So you could have fried clams, and you could have clam chowder, then you could have the clam fritter, and then you could probably have clams for dessert if you wanted it.
They do not have clam-flavored ice cream, although we have, not here, but we have sampled lobster-flavored ice cream. Not an idea whose time has come.
Perfect for July 4th weekend, guys. Thank you.
This is a great place, really.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, Lynn, bye.
Hey, everybody, gather around. Listen to that bongo sound. Grab the first one in your reach. Now we're gonna shake the beach. Do the clam, do the clam. Grab your barefoot baby by the hand. Turn and tease, hug and squeeze. Dig right in and do the clam.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Well, you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. We did a trivia question about how at a Chinese banquet, the whole fish is always pointed at the guest of honor. And that brought us this email from Peter in Dayton. He writes, "Your mention of the fish brought up a couple of other traditions from my mom. Both involve the banquet etiquette for the New Year's meal. It is tradition for the owner of a business to have a year-end banquet for his employees, first to reward them and also to give them their bonuses, if there are bonuses. The tradition has it that when the chicken dish is brought out, that the chicken's head should be pointed to the person that is getting the axe to start the new year. Now, can you imagine the tension as the waiter approaches with the chicken dish? Now, the second New Year tradition Peter wrote about is one that involves a fish again. A traditional year-end family meal is to serve a whole fish as the very last dish of this last meal of the year. Fish rhymes with remnants or leftover, so that is a portent for the year coming up, that every year there is something left over. This fish is also never eaten in order to preserve the good fortunes of the previous year. So maybe we could do the same thing with the watermelon on July 4th. We could bury a wedge to promise good gatherings for the next year. A new American tradition, maybe? I'm always game. The way cookbook author Sally Schneider thinks about food. She always gives herself and us, her readers, permission to trust instincts and imagination. That's where her recipes get these intriguing twists. Well, Sally is the author of The Improvisational Cook. Hey, Sally, it's good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn. Great to be here.
So, Sally, July 4th is coming. I would love some new takes on a great slaw.
Wonderful. I love slaws, and I love thinking outside the box about slaws, which don't just have to be cabbage. The Pennsylvania Dutch who first brought them to us started fooling around with turnips after they developed the cabbage slaw, which I think sets us on the road. Root vegetables, celery root, parsnips, turnips, rutabaga, carrots make wonderful slaws. Other kinds of cabbage make wonderful slaws, and cabbage-like things. Think Brussels sprouts, Lynn. Young Brussels sprouts, shredded, kale, collards, very finely shredded, which we call a chiffonade when you cut it crosswise across the leaves. I love somewhat tough, rough, slightly bitter greens like dandelion. I once made a dandelion and snow pea slaw, cutting the dandelions up and slivering the snow peas and then tossing it with basil and lemon peel and chives.
Yeah.
The gist is think any crunchy, gradable vegetable or combination of vegetables.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that you want to dress with either a creamy dressing or a vinaigrette. So you can be thinking fennel, celery, peppers, cucumbers, radishes. You know, practically the whole farmer's market can be in a slaw.
So what kind of creamy dressing do you like?
My classic creamy dressing that I use mostly for coleslaws is sour cream, buttermilk, a little cider vinegar, Worcestershire sauce, a few dashes of hot sauce, pinch of sugar, salt, pepper. That's the base.
Mm-hmm.
Into that, I can throw different flavorings. If I want to do the celery seed kind of slaw, which is an old American slaw, I throw celery seed in. I love doing it with masses of cilantro to turn it into a cilantro and cabbage slaw. But you can use any creamy element, heavy cream, creme fraiche, sour cream, mayonnaise, all of those work well.
Now, what about the other end of the spectrum, the non-creamy?
Well, for my money, a vinaigrette is the best all-purpose slaw dressing. Think of different kinds of fats you can use. I particularly love roasted nut oils like hazelnut or walnut oils, sesame seed oil, a roasted peanut oil, and of course, a great extra virgin olive oil. With a good vinegar, cider vinegars are great, mm-hmm. sherry vinegar, balsamic. You can mix vinegars. The key is to get enough vinegar and enough salt in the slaw, because what will happen is once you dress it, something happens with the vegetables, the sort of chemistry changes, and you'll find that you need to keep adding salt and a little bit of vinegar in small amounts to lift the flavors to make sure you maximize the flavor.
That's a great thing to know. Do you like to go the sweet-sour route? You know, I'm thinking of the kinds of slaws I've had, let's say, in North Carolina with barbecue, where they're sweet and sour and crunchy all at the same time.
They can be totally great, especially with those barbecued meats. And those are basically vinegar, often just white vinegar, I've seen, and they're still somehow delicious. Or cider vinegar with a little of a neutral oil, sugar, and then, again, the flavorings you might want. Personally, with just about any kind of barbecue and American-style meat, I like the creamier slaws. Somehow, for me, they cool out the heat mm-hmm. and the smoke, mm-hmm. and it's almost like they act like a sauce.
So you could take turnips and shred them really fine, toss them with your buttermilk, sour cream, creamy dressing, and, you know, you're essentially there. You could throw in nuts if you wanted, or carrots, or anything else you like.
Apple would be great.
Oh,
a little pear.
Yeah.
Lemon
yeah.
zest. I mean, you know, really it's a question of seeing what's around or what you feel like, throwing everything into a bowl, dressing it, getting other ideas and throwing them in, tasting it as you go. You know, they really evolve.
I love it. All right, I know what I'm going to do. Underripe peaches are going to go in for crunch.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Okay, you've created a monster. Thanks, Sally.
Always a pleasure.
Food Authority Sally Schneider is author of The Improvisational Cook. Now, for Sally's recipe for root vegetable slaw, go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out our newsletters, our podcasts, and information on our new book, inspired by this very show, How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. Now you're going to find it all at splendidtable.org. Coming up, a new grill idea for the 4th and the brilliant burger. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Although John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine, it's really grilling that's part of his DNA. And that is why we have him here today on the grillingest weekend of the year. John, welcome.
Nice to be here, Lynn.
I want to know about smoke roasting. What is it?
Smoke roasting is a great technique. It's basically roasting in a covered grill using charcoal as your fuel. So you get a beautifully roasted food, and it's got a nice little smoky flavor to it, which obviously you don't get in the oven. So I think it's a great technique, and one that's not used enough.
And why do you think it's not used enough?
I think people just don't think of it. I think they're a little bit scared of it. I think they think it's complicated. One way that people have heard of it is the Thanksgiving turkey. A lot of people know that you can roast a Thanksgiving turkey in your grill, but they sort of do it without thinking too much about it, and a lot of people have not-so-good turkeys, and so they get scared away from this technique, which is too bad because it's really a great one.
So what do we need to know? How do we make it work for us?
Well, first of all, you have to have a big enough covered grill. You can use any covered grill, but it's got to be at least 22 inches in diameter or you're not going to have room, because the key to this is to never have what you're cooking directly over the coals. It needs to be off to the side of the coals so it's cooking with indirect heat. Otherwise, it's going to char on the outside before it gets done on the inside. And people also, I think, often use too many coals. You want to use about enough to fit in a shoebox, which, you know, of course, shoeboxes vary, but this is grilling, so it doesn't have to be exact. But just, you know, maybe 3 or 4 good handfuls of fuel.
That's not a lot.
And get that going. It's not a lot. And you need to refuel about every half hour as you cook, because you want to keep the heat more or less steady. If you put too much more than that in terms of coals, you're going to have the heat too high, and again, you're going to burn what you're cooking on the outside before it finishes on the inside. You want to be in the, like, 325 to 400 degree range. So don't use too much fuel. Make sure that whatever you're cooking is not directly over the fuel, and you're almost there.
Can you do this with anything? I mean, anything from, like, a thick pork roast to a chicken to...
Absolutely. Whole chicken, whole duck, a thick pork roast, a big beef roast, whole fish is good this way. Anything that you're looking to cook, anything that is really too big to cook directly over the coals, but not so tough that it needs to spend 4 or 5 hours over the coals like barbecue does.
Yeah.
So it's
kind
of the anything that you would ordinarily roast in the oven is totally appropriate for this.
Vents. Now, all of these, you know, I'm thinking of most grills have vents. Now, should the vents be wide open?
Some don't have vents, and you can't really use those because you need to have enough air flow to keep the fuel going. I leave them wide open, just open, and you can close them a little bit if you feel that it's getting too hot, but it's easiest to just leave them wide open.
Now, the fuel that you use, when you say charcoal, do you mean briquettes or do you mean wood charcoal?
You can use briquettes. I always prefer lump hardwood charcoal because it burns cleaner. And in this case, when you're grilling, you don't really get that much of the flavor from the smoke because the food doesn't spend that much time over the grill. But in this case, you're going to actually get a lot of flavor from whatever it is you're using as the fuel. So this is the place to use wood chunks, like fruit wood chunks, or those vine clippings that people are always talking about.
Right.
They actually work here. You put them on the fuel, the smoke from the clippings or the hardwood actually flavors what you're cooking.
Would this be the place for the soaked chips of,
absolutely. Soaked chips are great. And since you're refueling every half hour with your charcoal, you just put the chips in or the hardwood or whatever you're using in at the same time. And if you use, say, a fruit wood, if you can get a hold of it, you're going to have a very sweet smoke. Mesquite is that spicy smoke. So you get to choose what additional flavor you want to add to whatever you're cooking.
I see people eyeing the apple tree in their neighbor's yard
around
now.
Absolutely. Go out there.
So it sounds, because every time I've tried this, but I realize now I'm using far too much fuel. Everything gets far too done on the outside and it's raw on the inside.
I think that is the number one mistake, is people use the same amount of fuel that they would use as if they were grilling. If you've ever had any experience with barbecuing, you're using just a little more fuel than you would doing barbecue.
Mm-hmm. John, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine and co-author of Barbecue: Recipes, Techniques, and Tools. Now, you can find his recipe for smoke-roasted chicken thighs on the website, splendidtable.org. Now that media folk are tossing out those magic words, sustainable, endangered, and local, at the drop of a hat, it's It's good to be reminded of the people who have been in the trenches for decades investigating what those words really mean. Ethnobiologist and conservationist Gary Nabhan has been called a primary shaper of the indigenous foods movement. His work in this area has earned him, among other honors, a MacArthur Genius Grant. Well, Gary has organized a collaborative called RAFT. It is laid out in his new book, Renewing America's Food Traditions, Saving and Savoring the Continent's Most Endangered Foods. Gary, welcome.
It's great to be with you, Lynn.
Now, Gary, Renewing America's Food Traditions, the project is called RAFT. What is RAFT?
It's sort of a life raft for rare foods. It celebrates and then attempts to save the food diversity unique to North America and the traditional foodways associated with that diversity.
So can you give me an example of a food?
Well, we're concerned about everything from abalones and sheep to leatherback turtles and heirloom vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these foods were once mainstays of American diets. A century ago, you could not imagine that we would not have cod on our tables or certain kinds of pumpkins or watermelons. And now there may be just a handful of growers on the entire continent that still cultivate these foods, or fishermen that know how to get them without hurting the populations. But let me tell you about one that I rediscovered on a field trip to Baja, California, just south of the U.S.-Mexico border.
Uh-huh.
I went back to the original olive tree that was brought to the west coast of North America, the Mission olive. And it's a 300-year-old tree that is bigger than a Volkswagen in terms of the size of its trunk. But it has these absolutely delicious, small but exceedingly luscious olives that have grown on that tree every year for more than three centuries.
That Mission olive is very popular in California. It was. I mean, I remember hearing about Mission olives.
That's right.
Yeah.
But now the land fragmentation that's happening in Southern California is sweeping away grove after grove. And now from some tree transplanters, you can have one plopped into your front yard for the cost of about $2,000. But we're losing that tradition of Mission olives being part of the fabric of Southern California as it has been for centuries.
Uh-huh. Did they disappear because change happens? There are things that are no longer practical, no longer needed, or did they disappear for other reasons?
Some of these foods are absolutely delicious and did not leave our tables because of lack of taste or quality.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the black sphinx date that grows in a neighborhood I once lived in, Phoenix, is probably the original fruit in the Garden of Eden. It's sinfully delicious, but it only stores for 2 or 3 weeks before it starts to spoil. So it is not good for shipping across the country,
right,
and keeping in a refrigerator. It will start to mold or ferment within a few days. But on the seasonal menus of this country that are coming back in every restaurant that I know,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
these foods still have a niche.
So how do you determine, how does the group determine what is worth saving and what should be let go?
Well, we're not doing this alone. We've had workshops in each region of the country, each food shed, we call them, and 40 to 50 farmers and chefs and food historians and folklorists help us make a determination. And if one of these foods is available in less than three venues, for example, farmers markets or tribal fairs or food festivals, mm-hmm, or restaurants, seed catalogs or nursery catalogs, we consider it endangered. If it's in 4 to 6 of these venues, we consider it threatened and we still watch it. Greater than 6, it still may be at risk because some foods that were once common, like the passenger pigeon or cod, are now endangered or, in the case of the passenger pigeon, extinct.
Hmm. You bring back or you try to protect a food, but how do you make these more than curiosities? I mean, how do you make these things really relevant to the way we live today?
Well, we're trying to remind people of how much these foods have been part of our American heritage, that the foodways associated with the seeds or the fruit or the fish are what it means to participate in American culture, from sowing seeds and casting nets and praying for rain to the preparation and serving and storytelling with them. So we're not just trying to save the genes. We're trying to save the entire cultural context. And that's why we're having across the country a number of American traditions picnics. We've had six already that involved about 2,000 people, some 50 chefs and over 100 farmers and orchard keepers and fishermen, to bring these foods back into the heart of what it means to be American.
Gary, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Gary Nabhan is an ethnobiologist, founder of RAFT, and he's editor of the book Renewing America's Food Traditions, Saving and Savoring the Continent's Most Endangered Foods. Now, you can get the recipe for Santa Maria Pinquito Bean Salad on the website, splendidtable.org. Call David Rosengarten, the man with the golden palate. Now, there's two meanings here. David knows his eats. He's paid his dues in the food world with his words and his personal tastes. But David has also figured out a gig where he can taste just about anything, short of pure gold. David is the creator of the Rosengarten Report newsletter, where he tracks down the best of everything and anything and educates you in the process. Well, in honor of the season, David has been after what he calls the monumental burger. David, welcome.
Lovely to be with you, as always.
David, I want to talk to you about burgers because you have written a tome on the subject.
Let's talk.
Yeah. You make the distinction between the burger most of us can make at home, which is a good burger, and the great burger, which is usually only found in a restaurant. But you're going to tell us how to do that great burger. So I gather the beginning of this should be the meat, right?
Yes. And don't you agree, Lynn? I mean, when you have a burger that's really striking, usually it's in a restaurant.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. Yeah.
Most of us, when we make hamburgers, we go to the supermarket and usually see, I guess most of it is this ground beef
right. That
looks very, very ground. nice and red, but very, very ground, very, very finely ground. And, you know, increasingly there's been less and less fat in supermarket beef. I'm against that. I think, you know, you need a good 10 to 20% fat in the beef to make it really taste beefy and buttery. But when I'm at the supermarket, I always look for a different type of grind, and sometimes you'll see the two types at the same supermarket. Do you know that grind that looks sort of like wavy noodles?
Yeah,
that comes out
yeah, exactly, yeah.
See, now we're getting there. I far prefer that to the heavily chopped one because that wavy noodle one leads to a texture in a hamburger that's kind of like beefcake. You know, it kind of like falls apart. It's gentle and it falls apart.
Yeah.
To me, the great evil in hamburgers is tight, knotty, condensed. And people do this in so many ways. They buy the wrong meat. They shape it heavily when they are making that, when they're shaping the hamburger at home.
Compress it a great deal.
Compress it, yeah. And also, of course, you know, the all-time great no-no when the burger's on the griddle or on the grill, press it down with a spatula.
So you can get all the juice out of it before you eat it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that is the main reason. Don't take the juice out. But it also compresses the burger and makes it, you know, chewier and denser. I love a light, lovely burger that just kind of falls apart. You know, it's the same concept as eating a great barbecue spare rib with the meat just sort of falling off of the bone into your mouth.
All right, but what cut of meat is going to deliver the fat and the flavor that you want?
Yes. Now, in the supermarket, you will often see the choice between round and chuck. And they'll also say sirloin, though sirloin has become such an indefinite phrase. I'm not sure exactly where that comes from. And that one's a little bit more expensive. But in my tests, it wasn't really any better than good chuck. Chuck is where it's at for me. I'm a chuck man.
And that's the shoulder of the animal.
Yes, it's a large area in the upper part of the animal's body, and it even extends into the neck. And now, Lynn, we have hit it. That's the holy grail.
Okay, so we've got the chuck, ideally the neck. We've got this wavy grind, which is a little coarser than the grind that we normally see. And it's lighter. It's not. It's fluffy yet.
Fluffy. Keep it fluffy, yes.
Shaping the burger. And do you season it before cooking?
I do, just with salt. Maybe a little bit of black pepper.
Okay.
But I don't like to season it with other things. Shaping is very simple. You want to do it as gently as possible, as we said. And I do have an ideal size. I like a burger that's about 5 ounces in weight, approximately 4 inches in diameter, and approximately half an inch thick. And that burger to me is, it's plenty thick so that you still have all the, you know, and of course, let's not even discuss degree of doneness. To me, it's got to be rare or medium rare. But at that thickness, half an inch, you still have plenty of, you know, opportunity to keep it rare inside and get it crusty on the outside. But it still is very manageable, fits in a bun well, and takes condiments well.
And you do not press it as it cooks.
Never, ever, ever, never. But you know, here's the other important thing about cooking tips at home for burgers. I think most people assume that a great, great burger is a burger cooked on a grill.
Yeah.
And grill burgers are great. But I want to say a word for the griddle or the frying pan burger.
Uh-huh.
Because it's a totally different kind of burger. It's a different animal, so to speak. It's a different flavor. You know, I used to go to this place in New York that had been around for 50 years, and they had this griddle that probably cooked 7 trillion hamburgers in its time. And the old flavor of beef fat was had kind of settled into that griddle, and it gives the hamburger a certain taste that's different from a grill burger. So what I do is I take pieces of beef fat, like just cut it off of a steak, keep them in my fridge for a while, age them for a week or two, and when I'm ready to do a burger in a frying pan, I take a little piece of fat and I melt it in the frying pan. And then my pan tastes like that 50-year-old griddle.
You are the only person I know who ages their beef fat before they cook with it. I love this. I love this.
Well, now listen, if I needed an ager or if it took 6 months, you know, it would be ridiculous, of course, but it's just a little piece of fat in your fridge, no problem.
David, thank you.
My pleasure. Good talking to you.
David Rosengarten is author of The Rosengarten Report. Now, you can find David's burger recipe at splendidtable.org. And by the way, the USDA and the CDC recommend cooking burgers to 160 degrees at their centers, which is medium well. Okay, time for this week's trivia challenge. It's something to mull at the 4th of July picnic table. The question is, which watermelon is priced up there with a diamond from Tiffany's? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You could get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. It's something to contemplate at the picnic table. The question was, which watermelon is priced up there with a diamond from Tiffany's? Well, it's Japan's Densuke watermelon, and at a recent Tokyo auction, one melon sold for $6,100. Now, the Densuke is a sleek black melon. It grows only on the island of Hokkaido and supposedly tastes sublime. Now, at 17 pounds, that watermelon worked out to cost $358.82 per pound. Talk about blowing this week's budget. Now, if you think $6,100 is a lot for one melon, a while ago in Tokyo, a pair of cantaloupes went for, are you ready for this? $23,000.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
it's time for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Let's get to the phones. We have got Tucker on the line from Madison. Tucker, what do you want to talk about?
Well, my question is about mead. Yeah, it started to show up in our local markets.
Uh-huh.
And I don't really know anything about it, although just the word conjures up a great image. I'd like to try it, but I don't know how to serve it or what to serve it with. So I thought you might have some advice.
Well, this is what I think I know about mead. I mean, I immediately think medieval castles and, you know, England and maybe even Henry VIII raising his cup. It's an alcoholic drink that's made from honey. And I think depending on the kind of honey you use, that will dictate much of the flavor. I've seen mead because I know some people in Colorado were producing it and they had spices added to it and that kind of thing. And I think that that's something that's not unusual. Now, I haven't drunk it in a very long time, but I do remember you can get it dry and you can get it sweet. And just off the top of my head, what I would do if it's not wildly expensive, and generally I don't think it is try a little of each and see what you like, because I think this is going to be just like any other alcoholic, beverage, that some you may like and some you won't. But the other thing is that it always occurred to me that the sweeter one would be great to drink with fruit desserts.
Okay.
You know, if I think about, you know, cherries coming in, and especially stone fruits. For some reason, stone fruits, I guess because of their lusciousness, to me, mead would probably be really swell with that.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that would be a good start for you. First of all, just get a couple of bottles and taste them. And I would try them lightly chilled to begin with.
Okay.
And the other thing you might want to do with it is some people like to boil it down and almost make a syrup out of it. And use that as a sweet, you know, over sweets.
Okay.
Yeah. But think fruits or think spicy, sweet, sour main dishes like Thai food or barbecue. Do you know what I'm – you see what I'm, where I'm going?
Yeah. Yeah, I see.
I wish I could tell you I just had a great mead tasting, but I can't.
Okay.
Hey, thanks, Tucker.
Great. Thank you.
You take care.
Bye.
You know, the reality is that you can make alcohol almost out of almost anything. And I guess, you know, if you didn't have grapes, you used honey. Call us, 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up next? We have got Jeff calling from France. Huh, from Chambéry. I think I'm pronouncing it correctly, Chambéry. Jeff, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I am very good. You may well be one of our first callers from France.
Oh, thank you. It's so nice to finally talk to you. I've tried for years and something always happened. And I, in fact, just came across an old cookbook of yours. I can't recall the name, but I've always enjoyed listening to your show and I have tried a lot of your tips. Actually.
Well, thank you. Thank you. What are you doing in France?
Well, I have a friend over here. Her name is Iris and she's from England. And she has bought an old castle built in the year 1500 and is slowly redoing it into a bed and breakfast. And she and I are going to attempt this summer to open a restaurant in the dining room.
That's a great, ha, what a project.
Yeah, it is a big project. And we have, over the last few months, got a license and the privilege licenses and everything. And this summer, we want to figure out what kind of menu to have for next summer. It's just going to be trial and error this summer.
Right, right.
And what I'm thinking is when I can arrange transportation, because it's expensive here like it is most places anymore.
Yeah.
Is to be able to go into the market each day, just buy what's inexpensive and fresh and cook that for the guests and the people coming to try the restaurant and then figure out a menu from that each day and then do a rotation. And I was wondering if you had any ideas, if you know the area. And
well, where exactly are you? Because I'm not familiar with this particular town.
Okay, we're right in the center of France. It's outside of Limoges. Limoges is course, where they may have the porcelain factories.
Right, right. And it's the, you're if you're not in the Auvergne, you're in that high.
We're near there, actually.
Very near there.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm, well, as soon as I think of that area, I think of those great green lentils, the lentils of Puy that are the most fabulous lentils. But this sounds like a good idea. Now, have you ever done this before? Have you done a restaurant before?
No, never. I worked for a man in Nice one summer from California. He had a villa and I was his private chef.
Uh-huh.
And then two summers ago, I worked or helped a couple from the Netherlands who had a bar/restaurant campground, and that was a lot of fun.
Oh, well, you've had some experience then.
Yeah, I worked for a caterer for 25 years, and it was in Durham, North Carolina. Most of our clients were Duke people, so during the summer when it was slow, I had to seek work elsewhere, and I'd been coming to France since I was 16. I worked as a model, and then to pay for a business school, I started doing part-time cooking work and then eventually went to culinary school.
So you have a fair amount of experience. Look, this is what I would advise you. I mean, I have not spent a lot of time in that area, but I've eaten foods from that area. And what I remember, first of all, Cantal cheese, right?
Right, I remember that. In fact, that's right near us.
Right, and Cantal is a lot like great cheddar.
Okay.
And I, as I recall, the other thing is, the blue of Auvergne, that fabulous blue cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have to tell you, we lived in Brussels, you know, and we'd roam France a lot. But one of the I love the blue d'Auvergne. It's just a particularly delicious blue cheese. And I remember one thing that I did with it, and it was in when the green garlic came in.
Uh-huh.
I would poach the green garlic until it was soft and puree it, and then I'd mix that with the cheese with scallion or chives, and I'd make it into, you know, make it rather thick. And then I'd roll that up in, you know, something like a romaine leaf and, you know, brush it with olive oil and grill that.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
It was. I mean, it gets, you have to just get it off the grill fast because it gets oozy. But boy, that could be a fabulous way to begin.
Uh-huh.
And I think you've got walnut oil in that area. And
right.
I'm just thinking, Cantal, which has that real cheddar-like quality, mm-hmm. you could shave that onto a plate. There's a in Switzerland, they do this with a cheese called Sprinz. They do big shavings with a vegetable peeler, so they fill the plate with these thin shavings of this fabulous hard cheese, and the Cantal is close to that, and then drizzle it with a tad of walnut oil and then local cherries.
Oh, yummy.
And that could be a starter, or it could even be sort of a savory sweet dessert.
Now, do you heat that up and then serve it with...
No, I would just let it go. I would
just
do
like,
that.
Like a
drop or two of walnut oil. And then when the cherries come in, because there are cherries in the center of France, I know, that are supposedly wonderful. And you could do that kind of thing.
Yeah, they're like the Washington cherries.
Yeah. And you could do that because you'd get the savory cheese, you'd get that really luscious walnut oil, and then you'd get that sweetness of the cherries. It would be just fabulous for people. I'm thinking really simple. Yeah, with slices of local, really coarse bread. I'm thinking of stuff that's really simple and not wildly expensive for you.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah. And I think anything like small game, you know, quail, pigeon, that kind of thing that you can butterfly and you can grill, you can marinate it with local herbs, you know, do it with whatever you've got in terms of local wine. Everywhere in France they make marc or cognac. You know, there's some sort of drink like that. That, a little bit of that with fresh thyme and garlic and that kind of thing. And you can do a slow grill of that kind of thing with just good salads.
Ooh,
you know, of greens that you get right from that market. Keep it simple, and especially in summer, and I think it'll fly.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to come over and we could just go out together and make up stuff.
Oh, I'd love for you to come over. We're going to be open until the tourists stop coming. And the name of the restaurant is Corrige, and eventually we want to be open year-round. I just have to figure out work status.
Right,
and residency,
right,
you know,
right.
But complicated.
Jeff, the greatest luck to you both.
Thank you.
And enjoy, and we may show up.
Thank you, and I love speaking with you, Lynn.
Well, thank you for calling. Take care, Jeff.
Have a good night.
You too. That takes guts, what they're doing, and I wish them well. It's what a great opportunity. 800-537-5252. Let's see, who is up next? We have got David calling from Miami. David, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I was going to talk about a great interview with a gentleman about terroir.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And the seeming mystery of terroir sparked another mystery that I had in the food world, something called umami.
Oh, yes.
Something I hear about and don't entirely understand, and I'm hoping you can give me some insights.
I'm not a scientist, but I'll tell you what I know.
Okay.
Umami is sometimes referred to as the fifth taste. You know, the four basic tastes are bitter, sour, salt, and sweet. But there's no accounting for that kind of savoriness that you get out of food. Red meat has it. Soy sauce has it. Parmigiano Reggiano cheese has it.
Mushrooms maybe even?
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh. And okay. Evidently, this is umami. And it's referred to as umami, at least in Japan. And what it actually is this savory taste that's imparted by glutamate that exists in certain foods and certain substances, and then another collection of substances that I can't remember the name of, but it's the combination of those two that just happen to exist. And a lot of times they exist in things that are fermented. For instance, Asian fish sauce and soy sauce have umami. Red wine has umami. And it's that's where the idea of monosodium glutamate comes from, that it started being manufactured to broaden, to open up flavors. But it turns out it naturally exists. Shiitake mushrooms have it. I'm trying to think. Pork has it. Tomatoes are loaded with it. And I think it's one of the reasons why tomatoes are so irresistible to most of us.
Now, has the food community at large sort of grasped this as really the fifth element?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's so much research being done now. For instance, there's some research done in Dijon, France, that tells us fat should be the sixth flavor, that fat itself is not just something you feel in your mouth and react to that texture and that appeal perhaps of it, but there's also a flavor component there. But the thing that's interesting about umami, and this is why cooks have jumped on it with, you know, both feet, is that it tends to enlarge the flavor of other things, which is, and for me personally, I cannot tell you what vindication this is, because in writing two books about food in Italy, I talked about Parmigiano Reggiano cheese and how it seemed to be almost unique in that when you added Parmigiano to a dish, it wasn't that you tasted the Parmigiano, it's that it seemed to enhance and bring up the character of everything around it. Well, guess what? It's loaded with umami. So what I was sensing, and a lot of other people were, I wasn't, you know, alone in this, was actually a scientific fact, and tomatoes are the same thing. You know, tomatoes were the poor man's wonder because they brought, for a meager amount of meat or a handful of beans or wild greens that cost you nothing, you added tomatoes and you got this enlargement of flavor and you got a lushness on the palate that was so satiating. And they were cheap to grow. Well, they're packed with umami. And what the trick now is, a lot of chefs, for instance, keep fish sauce in their refrigerators. You know, the Asian fish sauce that smells like old socks. But the reality is, you put a few drops of that into an oil and vinegar dressing. You put a little teeny bit of it into, you know, a fabulous pot roast or into a deglazing of the pan, you know, to make a pan sauce for something. You'll never know it's there. But it's so packed with umami, it's going to enlarge everything else.
Wow.
So you see, a little bit of these things are things that can really take up all of the flavor in a dish and can make everything else better. So that's
interesting.
Yeah, isn't it? And it's
really is.
Yeah, because it's fascinating because this explains so much about why, for instance, Asian food, especially things as simple, as stripped down to the essentials as Japanese cuisine can be so satiating. And it's all about this idea of chemical substances that naturally exist in foods that enhance flavors.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's pretty marvelous.
Well, you've sure cleared up an obscure food term and a couple of little arguments I was having around the dinner table.
Well, you know, I think, you know, this is why you keep a little soy sauce. You keep a little, you know, you keep a little of this stuff around and you'll be amazed.
Is the fish sauce that you mentioned, is that available?
Yes,
or is that
yes.
Something that you would encourage people to make?
Yeah, no. You can't make it. It's a fermented fish sauce, or if you did, you'd have to move out of your house. It's a very, very ancient way of preserving fish, and you'll find it in Asian stores. And it will come from Vietnam or from Thailand. And one of the brands to look for, you don't have to know the name of it, it has three crabs on the label. And it's not very expensive. A three quarters of a quart bottle is going to cost you $4. I store it in the refrigerator. You use very little of it. But because when you smell it, you'll see why. But the reality is that smell and that strength goes away in some way, and then everything else gets bigger. But start out just like an eighth of a teaspoon the next time you make an oil and vinegar dressing and see what happens. Hey, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this quote from Irma Bombeck. She said, "You have to love a nation that celebrates its independence every July 4th, not with a parade of guns, tanks, and soldiers, but with family picnics where kids throw frisbees, the potato salad gets iffy, and flies die from happiness." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now, information on everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Have a visit. You're going to find podcasts, newsletters, information on our book, How to Eat Supper, and a newly formed collection of inexpensive recipes that we're calling Cheap Eats. They're all gathered from our recipe archive, so don't miss out. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke, and our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.